home of Johnny Vandermeer. The date is Thursday, December 13th, 1990. Mr. Vandermeer lives in Tampa, Florida, and this is the interview. My name is Dan Austin. I'm at the home of Johnny Vandermeer, baseball pitcher for the Cincinnati Reds and White Sox and Indians in the 1930s and 19 Cubs. In the 1930s through the early 1950s. This interview is for the National Baseball Hall of Fame as part of their oral history project in their archives. The date is Thursday, December 13th, 1990, at Mr. Vandermeer's home in Tampa, Florida. Mr. Vandermeer, would you give us the date of your birth, where you were born, something about your family, and as a kid, how you got interested in baseball?
Well, I was born in Prospect Park, New Jersey, a suburb of Patterson, and raised in a small town close by Midland Park, New Jersey. And I am from a Dutch heritage family, and I guess I was, I was raised during the days of the Depression, and my dad being a cripple, well, I never got no help from my dad because he was not interested in sports, and being an immigrant, why, he was only interested in one thing, was work, and I was raised in a small community, and of course, baseball was the name of the game back then, and like it is today. I proceeded through school and into semi-pro baseball, and was signed by the Dodgers. When I was actually 17 when I was signed with the Dodgers in November, and went spring training with them in February.
And so you're a first-generation American. Your father and mother came over from the Netherlands.
My parents came over when they were about from 12 to 14 years old.
I understand your nickname is the Dutch Master.
That's what they call me in Cincinnati.
That's what they called you in Cincinnati. So you played a lot of what we might call today Little League Baseball.
There was none of that in that village. No programs. Yeah, there wasn't any
right.
money for it.
Yeah.
So we made played among games. Ourselves and made our own amateur teams and semi-pro teams, and we fixed the fields, and we built the grandstand, and we were really part of it.
Yeah, you bet. So it was good old sandlot baseball. You round up some kids in the neighborhoods, and off you went to the field and played all day.
We worked all Saturday morning getting the field ready and played on Saturday afternoon.
Remember some of the kids that you played with in the night? I guess this would have been in the 1920s.
This was in the very early 30s and probably 28, 29. And it was a small Dutch community. And yes, they have a funny thing about it is all of the kids was on that team. We were a young ball club and had a good ball club. Played much older players and teams than we were. And every one of these kids turned out to be outstanding and very, very successful.
Whatever walk of life they went into, they played hungry.
You were hungry.
So, did you start out as a pitcher, or did you play other positions and then just kind of drifted over to the pitching mound?
No, I played, when I first started, I played the outfield. And as I matured and got a little older, why, I had a great arm, and so one day they decided to let me pitch a ball game. I actually only had about a year and a half pitching experience when I was signed.
When signed by the Dodgers.
Yeah.
So here it is in the early 30s, Depression, and signed by the Dodgers, and where'd you go then? You were what, 17, you said?
I was 17 when I was signed, but I was 18, I was 17 in November when I signed. But
who was the scout that signed you?
I was signed out of the office in Brooklyn. It was a Major League promotion, a National League promotion. I was picked as a typical All-American boy who had a chance to become a professional ball player. And this was a promotion, I think it was set up basically through Ford Frick, who was president of the league at that time. And it turned out pretty good because I was just one of the kids from a small town and succeeded in his dream and became a major league ball player. So it was actually an experiment that turned out well and even made the movie Tone News and everything else in the promotion. So
I haven't heard movie Tone in a year. That's where we saw the news in action at the Saturday matinee.
That's right. And so I was picked as a typical American boy who had a chance to play professional ball and go to the big leagues.
So you went over, your first season of professional baseball was with Durham in the Piedmont League?
No, I went to Dayton, Ohio.
What league was that?
That was 1933.
Okay, what league was that?
That was the Mid-Atlantic League. And in 34 and 5, I played for Scranton in the New York Penn League. And from there, I went to sold to Nashville. I was sold to the I was sold to the Braves, but I was having arm trouble. And before the winter was over, the club was broke. I was traded to Nashville for about five ball players, and went to Nashville and overcome my arm problems. And it was wild, and I was sent to Durham, North Carolina, the Piedmont. There I got straightened out. Of course, about that time, I was starting to develop much more because I was just about 21. And I received the Minor League Valuable Player Award that year, which was the first year it was given, and was sold to the Reds. Because it was a working agreement. In fact, Frank Lane was the business manager down there.
Who later was with the
White Sox.
The White Sox and Cardinals.
That's right.
In those days in the minor leagues, you hopped on a bus and went from one town to another. Whatever locker rooms and showers you had, you took, if in fact they had them, at the field. Remember some time starting, let's say, Durham? I guess you hopped on a bus after a game or slept in the hotel and given a dollar and a half for food allowance and woke up the next morning and on your way.
My first year in Dayton was, we call it the Mad Atlantic League because of the tremendous jumps that we had.
The Mad?
Mad. Instead of Mid, we call it the Mad. Because of the jumps and riding in an old 1922 white bus that I guess wide open it did about 35 miles an hour, and we spent our nights riding the buses going from town to town, and the hotel, well, wherever we got the cheapest rate, we had some real fleabaggers, and got a dollar and a quarter a day.
That was for meal money, wasn't it? That was only when you were on the road.
That's right. And if you left after 12 o'clock noon to go on a trip like to Zanesville, you only got 50 cents.
They had it down there pretty pat, didn't they?
They sure did.
Well, of course, I guess you could buy enough to fill part of the tummy for a dollar and a quarter a day.
It costs us a little bit of money every day. Making $125 a month, and I was pretty well paid rookie because a lot of guys was only getting $75.
So this was with Dayton in what the about 1933 then?
1933. They kept us like Grant Rickey used to say all the time. They kept us lean and hungry.
There weren't any multi-year contracts, and
goodness no.
I guess, did you see the movie Bull Durham? You know, of course, that's about the Durham, North Carolina team that you played on 50 years earlier. The reason I bring it up because when I saw it, I thought it was one of the best baseball films dealing with dialogue in the dugout. Did you ever see it, Johnny?
I was invited to the original showing in Durham. And unfortunately, I had to be someplace else, so I didn't see it. In a way, I was glad I didn't see it, because if they asked me any comments about the show, I got to disagree with you. I thought it was a terrible film of things I seen in the clubhouse and things that were never, things like that just do not exist.
Well, I know about the women in the bedrooms. I wasn't thinking so much that as the
Well, I took that into consideration because I was a ball player. Those things, goodness gracious, particularly when I was there, and Judge Brenham was the minor league baseball commissioner at the time, and he had his office in Durham, North Carolina, and he was he was with Judge Landis, and as tough as Judge Landis, I think.
Just as tough as Judge Landis?
Oh, yeah, he was a tough cookie. Great guy, great guy. So was Judge Landis. But they went by the book, and I don't think that if he was alive, he'd have never let that thing open up in Durham, North Carolina, that's for sure.
So you were, you turned your, you got rid of your sore arm. All of a sudden, maybe as you got stronger, minor league pitcher of the year or minor league player of the year. And what kind of record did you have then, and that singled you out as the minor league player of the year?
Well, I got to Durham about June the 15th, which is, you know, practically half the season. I struck out 295 hitters in 160 innings, something like that. And I guess that's what the basic...
Is that because of the combination of your fast pitch and sinker?
I started to get the ball over the plate, and I came up with a great curveball. I was quick, and I came up with a real good curveball. And the reason I was sent there was the catcher in the ball club was Johnny Gooch, who straightened me out. He had been with Pittsburgh for probably 12, 14 years, and he was the manager of the ball club. And
what kind of advice did he give you?
Well, I wasn't coming up over the top enough, for one thing, and...
Too much sidearm?
Well, I was three-quarters, and he wanted me over the top. And I developed my good curveball while I was there. And I started to get the ball over the plate. And I struck out, I think I struck out 14 the first night the first night I pitched in Durham, and I went on as high as 21. But that's where I found myself, and that's where I actually started to mature and got real quick. I was quick before that, but I got real quick as I grew older.
You mean the quick release?
No, I'm talking about my fastball.
Okay. And so next year you found yourself in the ballpark of Cincinnati.
That's right. I went to the Reds, and long about the middle of the season, I was a little unhappy about not being worked, and I was pitching about once every 10 days, 2 weeks, and of course the end result was I was wild again. You can't lock a young horse in the barn on Monday and then take him out 2 weeks later and put him in a race. So I asked Mr. Giles to send me to Syracuse, New York for a couple months, which he did, and then I got recalled at the end of the season. And up there, of course, I was working every fourth day, and that's what I needed. Anybody that throws real hard, you just can't pitch them once a week.
They need to be in that starting rotation once every 4 days.
That's right. That's right.
So you came back with Cincinnati then at the end of the season, probably in mid-August with Scranton, and got into the starting rotation then with Cincinnati?
Well, I'd been to Scranton before I'd been to Durham.
Oh, I see.
I went directly from the Durham to the Reds.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay. And... You mentioned Gabe Paul, a general manager, probably pretty astute when it came to negotiating contracts with ball players. What were you paid that first year?
Well, Gabe was our traveling secretary at that time.
Oh, I see.
I was affiliated with Gabe for 30 years, but Gabe was a traveling secretary, and Warren Giles was the general manager.
He was general manager, okay.
And major at that time, when you came up, you didn't get yearly contracts.
That's right.
You got the contract by the month. And I was quite fortunate. I made $500 a month, which was quite a raise from $150 in Durham a month. And I said the average major league ball player that came up at that time was anywhere from $350 to $425 a month. So I was quite lucky. And, but Mr. Giles did pay the option ballplayer to AAA. He paid us all $500. So
So you were in the upper upper bunch.
We were a little bit paid better than what Ranch Rickey paid his well boys.
In the mid-1930s, the Cincinnati franchise, I heard, was nearly bankrupt. And Powell Crosley bought it from a bank. And at that time, Lee McPhail then, you know, how can they get fans out to the ballpark? And said, let's put up lights. And what was that, about 1936 then, if I remember correctly?
I don't know exactly what year they put up the lights. Mm-hmm. I thought it was probably in the area around a little earlier than
okay,
that.
Okay, it may have been.
And they played a one-night game against each ball club. They only played eight ball games at night a year. And that went on for probably about 6 or 7 years. And when Mr. McPhail got let out in Cincinnati and went to Brooklyn, he put the lights in Brooklyn, and then he started to play a whole lot more night games. That's what started it. But before that, Cincinnati played for several years, one night against each club only.
So you came in with the beginning of night baseball as a pitcher. I've heard stories where when night baseball started that some of the pitchers would use a piece of white adhesive tape that they would put on their glove to give a kind of a, when they would release the ball, that the batter could see that white piece of tape as well as the ball and get distracted by either one. And I heard that you had to do it, but you decided that you hurt your finger or something, and so you covered it with mud. And, of course, the white tape later was...
I only done that when I had a blister on my finger. And it blackened up a little bit. But as far as putting tapes on gloves and stuff like that, no, I don't ever remember anything. I think we get a lot of sea stories in our game.
Uh-huh.
I think that's one of the
sea stories.
That's
one of the sea stories? Okay, well... Warren Giles, who later, I believe, became president of the National League after several years, what do you remember about him in terms of being a baseball executive?
Well, that club I was on, basically, all the young ballplayers that came up, like Whitey Moore and Lee Grissom and Frank McCormick and Harry Kraft, and these were all that were in the organization at the time, brought up under McPhail. And of course, when he got let out, well, Mr. Giles came in. And Mr. Giles was a great individual. He one thing I liked about Mr. Giles, and it also taught me something. But if Mr. Giles says something to you, there's not very many general managers in the big leagues whose word I would trust. I found that out later. But if Mr. Giles ever made a commitment to me personally, and I don't know about anybody else, I'd take Mr. Giles' word any time he wanted. If he gave me his word, that's all I had to have. I'd never have to have something. We had little side agreements and stuff like that, that he was a sole judge on, and whether you pitch good ball or you won so many little side agreements, not on a contract. And I think Mr. Giles was probably the fairest businessman that I was ever associated with.
So when you made an agreement with him face to face and you turned your back, that you knew that it would be honored?
To me, his word was his bond.
I heard, starting in 38, some fantastic Cincinnati ball clubs. Went to the World Series a couple of times there before the war broke out. And you were pitching with them, I think the first World Series that you were in was 1939 when you played against the Yankees.
Yeah, we got in that for four games and it was all over.
Didn't have time to... who was the manager of the of Cincinnati then? I think Joe McCarthy was probably a manager of the Yankees.
Well, Mr. McKechnie was there during most of my
Bill area. McKechnie? And,
well, I have to call him Mr. because I respected him very much.
Okay.
He was like Mr. Connie Mack, as Al Simmons and all those boys.
Oh, really?
Him Mr. Mack, you know, I call him Mr. McKechnie.
Okay.
And he was a very astute defensive manager. He was a great handler of pitchers, and he had to have his type of pitcher, and he had his certain little rules about don't let too many fastballs beat you. He wanted a pitcher to throw a curveball at his command. He wanted that pitcher to have command of that curveball for a strike.
He'd call some pitches to the catcher then during the game?
He liked pitchers that could throw a curveball for a strike regardless of what the count was.
Hmm.
And it is a very good philosophy because curveballs are a lot harder to hit than fastballs. And he was a very defensive manager. He used to pull the infield halfway in sometimes at the very early part of the ball games. And
why would he do that?
Well, he just didn't give anybody the time of day. I mean, he just didn't give up runs. That was his, he figured it was his percentage. And he played what we call percentage ball. And he played it from opening day to the end of the season. Sometimes it may beat you, but the majority of the times you would win by it. And he never deviated from it.
So he kept notes and little cards about every player posing and on your own team?
We didn't have that.
He just stored it up in his head.
You put it up in your head back when we were playing. If somebody hurt you, well, you should remember that.
Uh-huh.
And today, all the computers and stuff like this, I think that's highly, what I call highly, some of these clubs are highly overmanaged.
Uh-huh.
Particularly when you come to relief pitchers today, you see some of this ridiculous changing in the eighth inning and ninth inning with a pitcher having 6-run lead or 7-run lead, and they take him out for a pitcher. And
yeah.
That's all highly overmanaged stuff as far as I'm concerned. So the game has changed in that respect, but when we played, if you asked for a raise, the first thing the boss would ask you is, how many did you win? And you say, I won 16, 20. He'd say, how many did you finish? And if you would say 8, 10,
mm-hmm.
You say, what do I have to do? Pay two guys to win one ball game? Today, they're using a pitcher for the eighth inning and using a pitcher for the ninth inning.
Plus
I don't buy as highly overrated manager stuff and all this computer stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, a good ball player, if somebody beats you, somebody hurts you, somebody you can't get out, you shouldn't forget those things. Gosh, I can remember every instance of this very day.
Mm-hmm. You say the manager was a great handler of pitchers, and you mentioned a couple of examples. In those days, they really didn't have a lot of coaches there to just manage the outfielders or the take care of all the hitters and all the pitchers, although you generally had a pitching coach. Did he give you some tips in terms of style of throwing? You say he was a handler. I guess he really knew your potential.
We had two coaches on the club, but McKechnie handled the pitching.
Mm-hmm.
He was the manager, and he handled the pitching.
Mm-hmm.
He handled that. Now, today, why some of these clubs got six coaches on, I don't know why, but...
Mm-hmm.
That's a change in the game and a change in the world, I guess. And I guess I got the money to pay him. Back in our day, the coach didn't make very much money, I guarantee you.
Right.
And they didn't have any extra ones around either.
I'd like to go back to July 6, 1938 at Crosley Field, the All-Star Game. I think that must have been about the fifth or sixth All-Star Game. And up until... that time, the American League, I think, dominated. I think the National League had won one, but you were on that All-Star game at Crosley Field. And you pitched, I think, the opening three innings.
I won that game. I get the credit for that.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you a little story.
No. Okay.
I'll tell you a little story about that. The manager of the ball club is Bill Terry, uh-huh. who was a very good manager and a very brilliant individual, which he proved after he was out of baseball and business for him. He was a very astute guy. And we had a meeting up in the clubhouse for how to pitch to all the American leaguers. And I think all but one that year was probably the greatest American League all-star team this very day. Everyone, I think but one, went into the Hall of Fame. And that was Johnny Allen. When the hitters came up, like Dickey, Gehrig, Gehringer, Cronin,
DiMaggio,
Fox, DiMaggio, Al Simmons, these are all Hall of Fame players. Mm-hmm. And every hitter that came up, they said, pitch them low and outside, high and inside. Well, that's still the story today. So we finally got all the way through DiMaggio. That was his first All-Star game. And we got to right field, and that was Earl Averill,
yes.
who had led the American League in hitting.
Played with the Cleveland Indians.
And Terry says, well, wait a minute. He said, we will pitch everybody right down the middle. We're not looking for it. He says, and just pump it in there, John. He says, so that's the way I pitched. And I was fortunate enough to win that ball game.
So you held the fantastic array of, all those men made the Hall of Fame. And here you shut them out the first three innings.
They had Grove. Gomez started that. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's the only All-Star game or World Series that Lefty Gomez has ever won. Ever lost. Mm-hmm. He won all his other World Series and All-Star mm-hmm. games. And they had every pitcher that was on that club, as I said, except Johnny Allen, Lefty Grove, mm-hmm. Bob Feller, and Red Ruffing, and if you just look at that lineup at that time, I think it's the greatest lineup that ever appeared for the American League. Didn't it?
Well, I tell you, you must have been a little bit nervous coming up the first inning and looking there. I don't know who batted off, led off, but here you were looking at Gehrig and Gehringer and Bill Dickey. It must have made you a little bit nervous.
I wouldn't worry about them too much. As we were more guys like Fox and Simmons and Averill and DiMaggio, but they truly had a great ball club,
yeah.
And it was.
So
it
you kept it high and high and inside and low and outside.
I just went out there and had to go only three innings, mm-hmm. and I left everything quiet for three innings and got the ball over the plate and got credit for the ball game.
You ever have an opportunity to meet Lou Gehrig?
No, I never have spoken to Gehrig personally. Mm-hmm. I played against him a little bit in the World Series, and although I knew Ruth very well, I hunted a great deal with Ruth.
With Babe Ruth?
I
see a couple of autographed pictures of have with him.
I hunted deer with him in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York State, rabbit hunted with him. And, mm-hmm. I guess I was around Ruth in the hunting season for about 8-9 years.
Mm-hmm. You have some stories that are a story or two that you would like to share about the Babe? I know the books and volumes have been written about him, but, you know, from your own personal recollection.
Well, he was a great shot, I'll tell you that. I remember one time we were duck hunting down in South Jersey. Lynn Bogue Hunt was a great artist for birds.
Mm-hmm.
Was hunting with us, and had some officials from the state. And Big Brant was going by, and I never duck hunted before, and I wasn't doing too good, so he'd say, you shoot first, and I'd shoot and miss, and he'd knock him down.
Oh, really? He was good, good shot?
He was an excellent shot. Excellent shot. Hmm. Good a hunter as I ever hunted when it come to shooting deer or rabbit or mm-hmm. pheasants, or, you know, we hunted a lot. We had a bunch of old ball players that hunted together.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, he had retired by that time.
Ruth retired the year before I got started.
about 35, I guess, he retired there from Pittsburgh after he was traded by the Boston Bees.
That's right. I think Ruth's last year was 1936.
36.
And I came up in 37.
Seven.
But He's the father of the game for this 100 years. There's no question about
that. No doubt. You know. He's the one that, despite the players that have come after, or how young or how old, you think of baseball and you think of Babe Ruth.
Well, he could handle the game off of the field, and he could handle the game on the field. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like there was no place that the Babe could walk off the field that he wasn't recognized.
Mm-hmm.
He was just as recognized, I guess, as Franklin D. Roosevelt would be.
I'm sure.
So he was a great guy. I really he had some nightlife problems, but that's none of my business.
Well, that's we all have a few blemishes and and warts, but I think we tend to think about the other things. Were you there when they had a tribute to Babe Ruth in Yankee Stadium, I think, in 1948?
No, I wasn't there because I was in the National League.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we were playing someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
But he's Mr. Baseball,
Mr.
as
Baseball.
Far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. In 1938... of course, is when you hurled those two no-hit games, and I would be remiss not to bring it up. That was against the Boston Bees and the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I think with the Dodgers, it was the first night game in Ebbets Field. Or it was a night game.
That was the first night game in New York.
Uh-huh.
The second part to put lights in. As I said previously, we played one night game a year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Dodgers, McPhail came in there, and they played more night games, and mm-hmm. that's what started the night.
Mm-hmm.
But night baseball wasn't new to any of us because we all came up through the minors, and all we ever saw was lights.
Yeah,
so,
mm-hmm.
of course, we saw the good lights in the big leagues.
Yeah.
No question about that.
Not as many shadows.
There weren't any shadows. Actually, you can see the ball better at night than you can in the daytime.
How's that?
Of course, you never take your eye off of it at night.
Oh, you're not as distracted as much as in daytime.
And at night, you're more apt to keep your eye on the ball.
I never heard that. I always heard saying it was tougher to hit to be a nighttime baseball player than in the daytime.
Well, there's a lot of hitters that were much better hitters at night. Ted Kaczynski was one of them. Ted Kaczynski.
Mr. Muscles, huh?
Yeah. Of course, he was a great ball player. But,
yes.
He was a great night ball hitter.
Yeah. So you're not as distracted from all the stuff behind, and you just keep your eye on the ball.
That's right. That's right.
Crosley Field, you know, one of the old historical parks that, of course, was torn down, and they have Riverfront Park Stadium now. But I heard it was called the Palace of the Fans. That was the nickname for it. Did you ever hear that term about Crosley Field?
Well, it really was because in the older ballpark, such as you have as an example, the Red Sox ballpark today, the fans are much closer to the field.
Mm-hmm. Part of the action.
They even had seats extended beyond our dugout, that they could look into our dugout. I think it was about four rows. But they were much closer to the field, and I think that the fans were more part of the game because with the round ballpark you have today, as an example, with the round ballpark today and you have a football field in it, you are the farthest away from the 50-yard line in the seat today. You're closer to the football field when you're in the 20-yard or behind the goalpost.
That's right. Yeah.
Making a difference. I'm talking about, I feel like the polo grounds. Mm-hmm. The polo grounds where I would be different.
Mm-hmm.
But I prefer, if I hope that the Red Sox never get rid of that ballpark up there. Because you can hear things said, and the fans can get on the umpires, and the umpires can hear every word they say, and you get in these big ballparks, and all you hear is yah, 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 and you don't hear any words.
Yeah. And they're built for crowd control rather than being part of the game.
That's right.
I understand Crosley Field had some kind of terrace in front of the left field wall.
Mm-hmm.
Given that and what else you remember about the park, did you have to pitch differently in Crosley Field compared to Ebbets Field?
No, not really.
Of course, the Polo Grounds, you'd pitch differently.
Well, Ebbets Field, you'd pitch differently because you had a short porch in right field.
Yeah, that's right, like Yankee Stadium.
And Crosley Field, while we had a 387-foot fence for a long time that shortened up later.
Down the
right field, and left field was 330. So it was it wasn't a little ballpark by any means.
Yeah.
And of course, we had the greatest ground crew, I guess, there was in the history of baseball, the Schwab family. We had excellent playing field. Now, the bank that you're referring to, that ballpark was set below street level. And there was a sewer. There's a sewer that runs from that ballpark into a creek, and that creek goes into the Ohio River. So when they had the big flood, the water came up from the river, up the creek, and through the sewer pipe, into for the drainage of the field. Mm-hmm. And consequently, when they had, I think it was 38 foot of water into the ballpark or more during the flood. When that water went down, we played opening day. And we couldn't sit in the dugout because that creek wasn't low enough flowing into the Ohio. So we had benches all along third base or first base. We sat along first base. And I remember...
We sat along third base,
and the home club sat along first base. And I remember because Pepper Martin was on the ball club of the Cardinals, and he was one of these guys that used to let that bat fly once a ball game. And I'll tell you, boy, we were all low bridged on that bench boy when he was up there because we
kept loose, didn't you?
Kept that bat fly out of his hand. But that was a there was. Water came right over the center field fence in that one. And, but we opened up the opening day.
Still did anyway. Grounds crew got out there and did a spectacular job.
As the water went down, they had big pumps, and they washed the seats down and got everything on the field and then cleaned off the field. So the Swap family did a great job on it.
Going back to consecutive no-hitters. The first one was against the Boston Bees. Was that in Boston?
No, that was in Cincinnati on a Saturday afternoon. It was a normal ball game. I had average stuff. I didn't have real... I felt that I didn't have my best stuff, but I had a good sinker. And there was a tremendous amount of ground balls hit to second base and shortstop. Billy Myers and Lonnie Frye.
Billy Myers?
Billy Myers, our shortstop.
Is that the fellow that later was a minor league manager?
No. He's much younger.
Okay, it must have been.
There were no tough plays other than there's one on the bank out in center field for Harry Kraft.
With Harry
was a great outfielder. He was one of the great ones. He could get a ball like Terry Moore or DiMaggio, great fleet-footed outfielder. So Harry had no trouble. Maybe somebody else might have had, but not Harry didn't. So there was no spectacular plays in either ball game.
Umpires, any call any close one in that game that might have made a difference?
No, I experienced that couple of years later, though. I lost one with an umpire, though. I didn't go that road.
The second game with the Brooklyn Dodgers at Ebbets Field.
Well, that was a far more difficult game because McPhail kept selling tickets. So we naturally get up to warm up at 12, 14, 15 minutes in advance, according to weather. And I started to warm up, and I probably was warming up for about 5 minutes, and I was told to sit down. The crowd hadn't gotten into the ballpark yet. So I sat down for about 10 minutes, and then I was told to get up again. So I started up again. I was up there for about 5 more minutes, and I was told to sit down again. So sat down for another 10 minutes, and got up, and I warmed up the third time. Of course, by this time, I'm perspiring pretty good, and I'm loose. And we're now we're starting at probably a half hour or more late.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular night, the fans from my hometown came down to give me a night. And there's an old saying about any time they give you a night, that you're usually in the pitcher, you're usually in the showers by the third inning. So I had that on my mind, too. So there was probably about 1,200-1,500 people from my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, the game started. And I had probably thrown an extra 50 balls.
Extra 50 balls in that
warming
game?
Warming up. I warmed up three
warming
times.
Up, okay.
So, you know, that all takes a toll. But I had no trouble about it. I was always strong, and I finished the ball game with just about as good stuff as I started with.
I heard a story that Bill Stewart was the plate umpire,
mm-hmm.
and that he called a ball, you thought it was a strike or it was awful close, against Cookie Lavagetto. And that he came up to you afterward. You got Lavagetto out, of course, but they came up after the game and said, hey, I blew that one, Johnny, but you got him out anyway.
Well, the hitter...
Maybe that's a C story.
No. The hitter happened to be DeRocher.
Oh, Leo DeRocher?
And it was the last out of the ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two strikes on Leo on the ball. And I threw a fastball. And I had about... I'd say I had a good 3 inches of the plate or more. And he called it a ball. And the reason he called it a ball was because Lombardi was a 6'4". Stewart was probably only about 5'8" or 5'9".
Mm-hmm.
And Lom came up and screened Bill Stewart out. And any time an umpire gets screened out,
mm-hmm.
well, he'll call it a ball. And I looked into the plate. And I let him know that I didn't like the call.
Mm-hmm.
And Lom said something to him. And that was a tough call for Stewart to do because, you know, it meant it was the last pitch of the ball game. And then Leo flew out to Harry Kraft in center field. And as it turned out, Bill Stewart was the first guy to the mound. And he said, John, if you didn't... get a no-hitter, he says, I blew it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that actually happened. But neither ball game was there any tough chances. I'm talking about
just good solid defense
into the stands or, you know, diving catches, mm-hmm. or so forth. There's
mm-hmm.
a lot of ground balls. But the play that was the outstanding of the game was a smart play. It was a physical play. With the bases full, I walked the bases full in the ninth inning after retiring the first hitter. Now, I was in trouble then. Bases full, one out. And there was a ball hit to Lou Riggs on third base. Probably about a two-hopper. And Ernie Coy was the fellow who hit it, who ran real well. And instead of going for the long double play at second to first, which Coy possibly could have beaten because of his ability to run. The force play was made at the plate. And when Lombardi turned to throw at the first base, Coy was kind of running on the inside of the line and Baum didn't throw it. So actually what the outstanding play of the two ball games was when Riggs went to the plate for the force up.
Played a conservative and got the sure out.
Got the sure out, and then we went for the last out with DeRocher.
And that's when it finally flew out to Harry Kraft.
That's right. So it was a physical play, a mental play, rather. That was the biggest thing of the game, rather than a physical play.
Almost at the end of this tape, I'm going to turn it over and more rather than getting interrupted, but what I'd like to, in the second half of this interview, is... mention a number of the players that you were with, like McCormick, Lombardi, Kozuski, I think Hank Sauer came up, maybe that was after the war.
Yeah.
But if you share some thoughts about those, as well as some of those on other teams that you like DeRocher, Pepper Martin, mm-hmm. that we could do it. And I'll turn the tape over at this time. start here. Just a moment. Okay, this is side two of tape number one, conversation with Johnny Vandermeer. You played with some great players back in the, you had a couple of World Series in a row, 39 against the Yankees, and then 1940 against the Detroit Tigers, which you did win 4-3, I think, against the Tigers. You were pitching in some of those games, I gather, the 1940 World Series against the Tigers?
Well, the 40s, I didn't pitch in the 39 series because I had a bad shoulder.
Oh.
In the 40 series, I was supposed to start the third game in Detroit, and about 10 minutes before the game, they said Gene Thompson was going to start. So I was kind of very disappointed about that because I had just overcome my arm trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been to Indianapolis to get it straightened out, and came back and won three or four ball games, and I don't believe I had lost any. I might have lost one, but I was back to my in my stride. But I was a little upset about it. Of course, we back in them days we didn't say anything about that. You know, mm-hmm. Today the player would run to the media.
Yeah, hold a press conference right out there on the field.
Yeah, so. Anyway, Gene started, but I got in the ball game in the first inning with the bases full and nobody out, and three in. But I went in and relieved Gene, and I got out of the inning unscratched. And I think we lost the ball game 3-2 or something like that, 4-3, 3-2. I darn near stole that one in relief, but I went in there with, in a lot of trouble,
mm-hmm.
But that was my only exposure to the series.
To the World Series, and Cincinnati took the series 4-3.
That's right. That's when Bobo Newsom tried to pitch the fourth ball game with no day's rest, and he faced Derringer with 3 days rest,
yes.
And that took care of that.
Yeah.
We finally got to Bobo about the third or fourth inning.
And the name Bobo Newsom, you know, rings a bell. I guess he was quite a clown, wasn't he?
He was a character, but he was also a damn good pitcher. I'd like to have about four of him.
You'd like to have about four of him. I think, didn't he, after the war, pitch for the St. Louis Browns?
I don't know.
I just don't remember, but as a kid growing up in Kansas City, of course, the Cardinals were in St. Louis, and that was the closest major league team, and it seemed like...
I never saw the St. Louis Browns play a ball game.
Well, given their record, except for 44, I don't know if there was much excitement to see in Sportsman Park.
Well, they trained, you know, out in the West Coast, so we never saw them in spring training either.
Oh, that's right. Because you...
them and the White Sox,
I
never saw.
You did your training down here in Florida.
That's right.
And some of the players that you were with in those days, one of them, Hank Sauer.
Well, Hank came to us after we had our good ball club,
mm-hmm.
And he'd never done very much with us.
Well, he swung a heavy bat, didn't he?
He had been in Syracuse for mm-hmm. us and had a lot of home runs and had a great year up there. And then he was with us about 2 years, and he just couldn't find himself in Crosley Field, and we traded him to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he started hitting the ball back in Chicago, so it was a great thing for Hank to go to Chicago and become a great hitter out there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had the only thing that ever upset me a great deal about was Ernie Lombardi, who took all those years to get into the Hall. I was very upset about that because he was our quiet leader. He used to say something about every fourth or fifth day. But he was the man that...
he was the spark plug for the team.
He was the spark plug for our ball club. And he was... There's nobody ever threw better than Lombardi because he threw a natural sinker. And everything he threw was down on the base. He didn't throw that ball head high or inside or out. He was a great... If I knew you were running, I wouldn't try to pick you off because I didn't have a good move.
Mm-hmm.
I'd get the good move to the plate and Lom would take care of you.
You'd take care.
And... the other thing he was great at was he was a great hitter. He's the slowest man in the history of baseball. He is the only catcher in the history of baseball that ever led a club twice in hitting. No other Barrow, or you can mention a lot of them.
Johnny Bench, or...
You mentioned any of them. He carries a lifetime batting average of probably about 306. The thing that was highly overlooked by the media was that Ernie Lombardi's lifetime strikeout record, I believe, is either only 21 or 22 times a year. And for a power hitter, there's nobody in baseball that comes close to that. I'm talking about Lom was a power hitter where he didn't hit that many home runs. He tattooed that left field fence of ours pretty good because it was so high. But all he could get on them was doubles, and sometimes I've seen him hit that fence many a time and only get a single.
Just ricocheted off right into the hands of the left fielder.
But you take all the great home run hitters, and you start with Ruth, and you go down through Fox, and you go through Greenberg, you can go through Johnny Bench, you can go through any of them, and a lot of those fellows struck out over 100 times a year.
Easily.
And we were a pitching ball club, and we were a defensive ball club. If we had some wallop on that ball club, as an example, Johnny Bench in Cincinnati had 300 hitters in the front of them, and all of them could run, and struck out over 100 times a year, sometimes as high as 130. Hmm. If Lombardi was hitting in that same spot and striking out only 20 times a year, he might have had a shot at Hack Wilson's RBI of 180 RBIs.
Which still stands.
And it took, a thing that really upset me was that Ernie Lombardi was put in the Hall of Fame after he was dead, and some 25 years later, and I always said that I'd be in Cooperstown when Lombardi went to Cooperstown, and I was there. I guarantee you I was there. He was a great receiver. I'll tell you a story about him. One day I was pitching in Chicago, and Pepper Martin kept running up and down the third base line. I cut one loose, and it was about a foot and a half outside, and Lom just reached over and caught that ball with that big pair of hams that we used to call
his barehanded hands. He caught it?
He caught it barehanded and threw it back to me. And the next ball, the hitter popped out, the inning was over, and I came back to the bench and I said to him, I said, we used to call him Muss. I said, Muss, if you're going to sit back there and catch me barehanded, at least shake your hand after you catch the ball, because the old man will take me out thinking I'm losing my stuff. I seen him do that on three occasions.
Oh, really? was this to give a little message to Pepper Martin running up and down third base?
I'll tell you. And as far as blocking that plate is concerned,
well, that was
he was as good a blocking that plate as anybody.
Yeah, 6'4". He probably weighed,
220? 235. And
he took up a lot of territory.
And he was tougher than tough. That's how tough he was. And baseball was his life. I was very disappointed that he was put in the Hall of Fame after all of those years, because there were so many who went in front of him that were good ball players. I'm not knocking that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that he was a much greater ball player.
When, as you said earlier, when you get outside New York and not as much media attention, then a lot of those players...
If he had been in New York or Chicago or something, he would have went in the first 5 years.
Mm-hmm. How did he handle you as a pitcher? Just by having him back here, and all of a sudden your confidence went up another 10 notches, or?
It might have been better during my career that I had a small catcher, so I know somebody like Lopez or Mancuso or somebody who would stay down more than Lom, because he was so big. I might have benefited from that from the viewpoint of control, because I was a thrower. I wasn't a spot pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that throws real hard is not a spot pitcher.
You weren't a junk pitcher like Eddie Lopat and some of them.
That's right. They're spot pitchers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And or like the Reds relief pitcher right now. They got a bunch of guys that just pump that ball. And that's the type of pitcher I was. And, I couldn't change. I wouldn't be around. And it's like power hitters, you know, they got to let that bat fly. And they say, why doesn't he swing easier? He wouldn't strike out as much. Well, he can't do that. If he does that, he throws his timing off, and he's got to let that bat fly. Well, same with hard throwers. You got to let that ball go. But we had some other great players in that club.
Well, one of them, Frank McCormick, at first base.
Frank was a great ball player. I would say that Frank was as great a fielder that I saw in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
He could take that ball out of the dirt. He had that rare ability to catch that ball in the middle hop, mm-hmm. which is the toughest ball to handle.
That line drive that would take that hop near the glove, then
no,
he could just...
And I'm talking about the ball that would hit about 3 feet in front of him.
Yeah, uh-huh. That short hop that would come right
in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank was a great two-strike hitter. We knew this on the club, but if I got traded off that club, I'd say to make McCormick hit the first or second pitch. Don't make McCormick hit. Don't pitch him when he's got two strikes.
Hmm.
He could guard that play. His strikeout ratio was low, and he was a much better hitter with two strikes than he was with no strikes. I actually see Mr. McKechnie put the take sign on McCormick on the first pitch in the jam.
Oh, really?
Of course, you had your great hitters that used to hit the first pitch. Moore, that played for the Giants, left fielder.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great first ball hitter. He'd get a base hit on the ball a foot outside on the first pitch. So we used to try to get behind him.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it works both ways.
Mm-hmm. I heard that he led the National League in fewest strikeouts in 38, 39, 41, which, as you said, he guarded that plate awful darn well.
Well, he was a good breaking ball hitter, too. Yeah. You see a lot of breaking ball with two strikes, and Frank was a good breaking ball.
Mm-hmm. I guess you played with Cincinnati when Ewell Blackwell, the whip, I think it was his nickname when he came up after the war. I think you were with Cincinnati at that time, and I think in 47 that he won 16 straight games, which is still, I guess, a major league record.
No, Hubble has 17.
Oh, Carl Hubble has the record.
At that time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that Blackwell was probably the... If I had to pick a right-hand pitcher, I'd say Blackwell, before he got hurt, was the greatest right-hander I ever seen.
Was it because of his delivery, that submarine?
No, he didn't submarine. He was a sidearm. He was a sidearm. And he had three quarters, but he crossfired.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's step one way and throw the other way. And the old saying, he'd look one way and throw the other way.
Oh.
And he was all arms, he was all legs. And a lot of pitchers, motion is very effective. And he had the motion. He had plus he had the stuff. I do not know of a right-hand hitter in baseball that ever won a hit against Blackwell. The only one who actually hit Blackwell was a left-hand hitter with the Braves. His name was Bama Rao. A little left-hander who used to squirt one here and squirt one there. And I remember one day Blackie threw a pit to a two-hitter in Boston. Rao got both the hits, squared one to the left and squared one to the right. But if I had to pick my pitcher, I thought it was the greatest pitcher I ever seen before he got hurt, I'd say it was Joe Blackwell.
Mm-hmm.
Bar none.
Mm-hmm. How'd he get hurt?
Well, he kept throwing across his body. And
wasn't using his legs, his back muscles and legs?
Well, when you crossfire, you throw across your body.
Mm-hmm.
And when you throw sidearm. And Blackie kept doing that, and we used to say to him, Blackie, save that pit for two strikes.
Mm-hmm.
But he felt more comfortable throwing that way, and finally, not being what we call a horse, big guy, 6'4", 6'5", he only packed about 185, 90 pounds at the most. And he eventually hurt his shoulder, and he never overcome it. But he was a